There is not even one woman among the 100 U.S. senators. People of both sexes and all parties can and do feel the injustice of that.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas.
Bella became one of only 9 women among the 435 members of the House of Representatives.
5 decades ago, the second wave feminist movement started preparing a new script for women. Marriage and children weren't the end game after all. Women could get an education, strike out on a career path, seek new intellectual endeavors. These kinds of cultural messages filled the air, and women took up the call, eventually showing up in medical schools, courtrooms, and academe in greater and greater numbers. But when you look carefully at those numbers, over the past few decades, they tell a more complicated story. In the world of politics, throughout North America and Europe, women seem to have flatlined, occupying only between 15 and 20% of political seats.
And all you see are men around the negotiating table? Is that the world? Is that not perhaps the missing equation as to why the world is out of balance?
In the world of finance, the numbers are worse. Of the top 500 companies in Canada, only 6% are led by women. In the higher echelons of law and academe, it's the same story, over and over again. So if societal barriers have lifted, and in individual cases, women have proven they can run a country or a company, what accounts for the poor showing? Well, maybe men and women are just plain different. Maybe men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
This is what women need. And men don't understand that because we're men, we're different. On our planet, we don't necessarily have to be noticed for our accessories. So there aren't a lot of male accessories. What there are is male tools. So we'll go over to the tool bench on Mars.
Pop culture guru John Gray's 1993 book concluded that men and women, hormonally, are out of sync. And so are their goals and ambitions. A hugely popular message. John Gray's book was eventually published in 40 languages. Sometimes it outsold the Bible. Chicago neuroscientist Lise Elliott.
John Gray, you know, writes these stories that are very appealing, and they have tapped into the popularity of evolutionary psychology. So it's easy for us to all imagine the caveman sitting at home with his remote control and his lazy boy tuning out, you know, the wife and chewing on his ham bone. But it's sort of a caricature. And whenever you paint men are like this, women are like that, you're glossing over just the enormous diversity within men and within women.
In the 1990s, other books showed up on the scene. Why Men Don't Listen, and Why Women Can't Read Maps, or Why Gender Matters. And then a new player arrived on this landscape, the MRI. What wasn't visible before now seemed to some like irrefutable evidence. Brain imaging proved that women and men have differently structured brains. Academics stepped into the arena. In 2003, Cambridge's Simon Baron Cohen, who'd done much work on male autism, published a book that developed the hardwired concept of the male systematizing brain and the female empathizing brain. This concept seemed to explain why there are so many more men in politics and finance and engineering. Men are wired to be leaders. And a woman's empathizing brain explains why, proportionately, women are more likely to become teachers or nurses. Cordelia Fine studied this debate in her book, Delusions of Gender.
There's always this tendency to think that we've reached the natural limit of equality. There are no barriers now, particularly for, you know, particular groups of privileged white middle-class women. And so if they're not making it, well, we can't see any external reasons why that's so. So let's look inside. Let's look for internal reasons. And of course, then we bring out the brain scans and say, well, look, here's this different pattern of brain activity here. I think we found our answer, ladies and gentlemen.
In recent years, this idea of biological determinism has picked up steam, firmly planting roots in the garden of childhood. More studies and more books explain that long-held notions like boys are innately better than girls at math and science seem to be true. And what followed, of course, was that girls are superior in language and the arts. But how much science is there in the science of sex differences? And what is this debate telling us about the culture we live in? Ideas producer Mary O'Connell examines these questions in hour one of The Gender Trap.
Walk into any large toy store in the 21st century, and the differences are starkly laid out. The aisles are coded pink and blue, right down to the color of boys' and girls' cell phones, and basketballs, and golf clubs. There's a gourmet kitchen cooking toy in pink plastic, a barrage of hairdressing tools adorned with girls only on the packaging. Some educators call this gender apartheid. And over the years, as one neuroscientist has observed, Barbie's waist has grown slimmer as the shoulders on boys' action figures have grown wider. Iron Man. In the multi-billion dollar toy industry, a raft of retro Barbies have entered the market. A 1965 version carries the script, "I have a PhD in fashion." The first talking Barbie famously burbled, "Math is hard." Carol Rivers and Rosalind Barnett co-authored The Truth About Girls and Boys, a book that studies the effects of gender stereotyping. A couple of years ago, they walked through the aisles of toy stores.
All the dolls and toys equipment for boys had an action theme. So it was something you could do. You could ride a tricycle, you could bat a ball, you could make things. It's a Lego thing, construction. For girls, it was quite different. It's very passive, very stereotyped stuff. Another thing that was kind of interesting are these Hot Wheels, these little cars, they're everywhere, that are sold by the millions. And they're big sellers for boys. And they come typically with a track. And so these are broken up pieces, and you can create anything you want. It can be an oval, it can have ups and downs and all kinds of turns. So it gives kids an opportunity to create an environment for these little trucks. Well, a couple years ago, I think it was Mattel, decided to put out a comparable little car for girls. And the car was similar in size, but it was brightly painted. It had a little figure in it, a driver. And it came with a preformed track. The track took you right to the shopping mall. So you put the car on the track, and it followed up into a spiral staircase, so you could stop at the hair salon, you could stop in the retail store, and you could have lunch. The toy manufacturer, trying to cash in on a girls' market, had a dearth of interest and creativity. You didn't create your own track. You just, you know, put the car on there, and there it went to the shopping mall.
We also looked at the packaging, and it was very interesting. In a lot of the science toys and the building toys, usually it was just boys pictured, but when girls were pictured, they were watching the boys. They weren't doing the building or the science.
You mean when it was actually part of the marketing, the girls would be just watching?
The packaging, yes. Kids get very, very early ages, we're finding, are picking up these stereotypes much, much earlier than we thought.
Now, this whole princess culture thing, it just seems omnipresent in a way that it wasn't when I was a child. I mean, girls are drenched in this. Peggy Orenstein wrote a book called Cinderella Ate My Daughter, and it makes the point it's not about a girl's interaction with a toy or her abilities, it's about looks. Does that make sense to you today?
It's strange because women in the real world, you know, are doing all kinds of things they weren't doing way back then, but yet these costumes and dolls don't reflect the reality at all.
Books in general would seem a safer bet than toys when it comes to gender stereotyping. Yet in the book Packaging Girlhood, we learn that in two decades of children's books that received the coveted Caldecott Award, one of the highest awards in children's literature, only one book out of 20 included a female adventurer.
I like princesses because they're like girls, and since I'm a girl, I like pretty things.
Do you have any superheroes?
No.
Now, boys play with superheroes quite a bit, don't they?
Yes.
Why do you think girls don't play with superheroes and boys do?
Because boys are more interested in stuff like that.
Why do you think they're more interested in superheroes?
Well, because almost all the superheroes are boys, like almost all the popular ones are boys.
Over the past decade, though, the multi-billion dollar toy industry is just one contributor to what's become a deeply gendered society. The birth of the MRI and other brain imaging techniques have allowed us to look inside the brain in a way we've never been able to before. And it's fostered an explosion of studies into the science of sex differences. One study conducted in the year 2000 appeared to be a game changer. It came out of the Cambridge lab of Simon Baron Cohen, a professor of developmental psychopathology. Just over 100 babies, just a few days old, were positioned to see a mobile and then positioned to see a human face. The study found that baby boys looked slightly longer at the mobile than girls, and girl babies gazed slightly longer at a face. Therefore, the study concluded, boys connect more readily with objects, girls with humans. Simon Baron Cohen.
There are very clear sex differences in the brain, and we see these differences right from birth. Some people wonder whether these differences in the size of the brain or in the size of different parts of the brain have any impact on the child's psychological development. And certainly we know that girls talk earlier than boys, their language is developing faster. The finding that the amygdala is larger in boys is interesting because in boys and girls' social development, their understanding of other people's emotions, girls seem to develop faster, their empathy is better on average, and this may well relate to this difference in the size of the amygdala.
From this study, boys connect more readily with objects, girls with human faces, there emerged an extrapolation. Boys, therefore, will do better at math and science and engineering, girls at language and the arts. In his book, The Essential Difference, Simon Baron Cohen outlined these two differently structured brains, the systemizing brain and the empathizing brain. More books followed in these footsteps. In 2006, neuropsychiatrist Luann Brissendine presented The Female Brain, followed several years later by The Male Brain. In her work and similar work done by others, the game changer seemed to be testosterone. This hormone, she says, will actually change the structure of the fetus's brain to a male brain, although the hard evidence hasn't been established yet.
So, you know, we all start off at the moment of conception where we either get an XX if we're going to be a girl, or we have XY if we're going to be a boy. And then by 8 weeks of fetal life, the tiny testicles in the male start to pump out huge amounts of testosterone that then marinates the brain, changing the brain circuits into the male brain. So by the time we're all born, we either have a male brain or a female brain.
Now, do we have MRIs of newborns, and can we tell the differences in the brains at birth?
You know, we do have some MRIs of newborns, but the kind of looking at a lot of the MRIs of newborns are only done if the newborn is having some kind of neurological problem. So we don't really have a lot of comparison studies of newborns looking at the gender difference yet. They're very, you know, it's very complicated to have a newborn lay in an MRI scanner still long enough to get their brain scanned.
But would that not be interesting to brain scientists? Like, because, you know, it would really, this is from the moment of life to see if those differences are there.
Exactly. So we haven't had the chance to look. And it's even hard, you know, when you get to the toddler stage, it's very hard to get them to lay still in the MRI scanner.
The Female Brain went on to become a huge bestseller, landing Luann Brissendine coveted interviews on CNN, the BBC, Der Spiegel, and in Oprah magazine. Differently structured brains seem to explain all kinds of sex differences. Men enjoy interpersonal conflict. No wonder they love politics. Women are natural peacekeepers. No wonder they don't. Women speak more words per day, twice as many as men. Women are chatterboxes, of course, men less expressive. These gender stereotypes seem to be finally proven by science. However, a community of serious critics was developing as well. A New York Times review of The Female Brain stated, quote, "You'd never know from reading Brizendine that beneath the sea she blithely sails are depths that researchers have only just begun to chart," unquote. The British journal Nature called her book, quote, "riddled with scientific errors, painting men and women to be different species." In 2006, Lise Eliot was busily researching exactly the same subject for a book. Her thesis, "Boys and Girls and Men and Women Have Differently Structured Brains." She listened into the cultural conversation about gender. A male brain explains why boys are more adventurous, girls more cautious. Boys have superior math and science skills, girls are earlier and better talkers. As the Chicago neuroscientist began to assess the quality of these studies, Lise Eliot grew more uncertain about her thesis. She looked at over 1,000 studies, including Simon Baron Cohen's much-heralded experiment with newborns.
There's actually been a bunch of studies over the past many decades which put together find absolutely no difference between newborn baby boys and girls in their social perception. But a study came out in the year 2000 out of Simon Baron Cohen's lab at Cambridge University in England that found with 100 baby boys and girls that boys showed a hair more interest in a mobile and girls showed a hair more interest in the human face. And there were many, many problems with this study. The most important being that the face that was being shown to the babies was actually the live face of the graduate student who knew the hypothesis that she was setting out to test. Any psychologist will tell you, you cannot insert yourself into the experiment. She should have used a photograph and compared looking time to the photograph versus looking time to the mobile. It's a big problem, and another problem with that particular experiment is that they weren't always blind to the sex of the babies they were studying. It's just a very, very flawed study. And so it absolutely needs to be replicated, but here we are 12 years later and it hasn't. And the reason is because the authors have gotten so much mileage out of this study. Almost everybody who writes about sex differences cites that study as evidence that boys are innately object-oriented, girls are innately people-oriented. It's a huge extrapolation. I mean, from what is a tiny effect, which doesn't conform to the rest of the scientific literature and is ultimately a very flawed experiment.
Despite the scientific criticisms, Parents magazine, citing the Simon Baron Cohen experiment as proof, stated, quote, "Girls prefer dolls to blocks or toys because girls pay more attention to people and boys are more enthralled with mechanical objects," unquote. By the time Lise Eliot started to write her own book, Pink Brain, Blue Brain, the associate professor of neuroscience at Chicago's Rosalind Franklin University noticed that studies showing innate differences between males and females were the studies that got all the attention. In fact, Lise Eliot says there was a very strong publishing bias in the science of sex differences. She calls it the file drawer problem.
There's a real problem with publishing negative data. If you're a scientist and you're trying to find a relationship between cause and effect and you fail to find that relationship, nobody wants to read about it, nobody wants to publish it, editors aren't interested. So scientists tend to put that data in their file or leave it in their file drawer. And this is certainly the case with sex difference research. So if you do a MRI study, for example, you do your original study, maybe you're looking at how the brain processes language, and you get to publish your paper. And then, if you reanalyze the data and you find a sex difference, oh, that's great, because then you get to publish yet another paper. And since we're all surviving publish or perish, the tendency is to get more publications out when you find a sex difference. If you don't find a sex difference, no editor wants to publish a paper with the title "Lack of Sex Differences in the Amygdala or
Why
Hippocampus."
Why not? Why not, though?
Well,
it's not as sexy. What?
Yeah, in the medical community, we have this assumption that the default assumption is lack of sex difference, and so it's only noteworthy when you can prove that there is a sex difference. So, but out in the popular realm, it's kind of the other way around, where we know intuitively men or women are different, and so if we can find a biological basis for that, it's much more satisfying somehow.
But why is it satisfying, and to who?
So anything that can, I think, reinforce traditional notions of masculine and femininity is, for most people, more comforting. You know, oh, that's the reason, you know, my husband can't talk to me, or that's the reason my daughter's struggling in math. We can pin it on some biological cause, then, I don't know, it takes the responsibility away from us to try to do something about our husband's emotional expression or our daughter's math ability. I think it gets us off the hook in our personal relationships, and maybe in society as well. You know, we can say, so what if there's not many women in physics? You know, they're obviously not hardwired to be interested in mechanical objects, and so it's silly to try to invest in all these programs to increase girls' representation in science.
In Pink Brain, Blue Brain, Lise Elliott concluded that, of course, there are small, innate differences between boys and girls. Boys are more active than girls. Testosterone helps out. The average boy is more active than two-thirds of girls, but the average girl is more active than one-third of boys. That difference grows as the culture encourages boys to be more active. Lise Elliott noted girls do start speaking earlier than boys, but only by, on average, just 1 month. Are girls more empathetic than boys? A little bit, says Lise Elliott, but many studies have revealed why. Girls' brains mature faster and earlier than boys, making it easier for them, for example, to read facial expressions. The other reason? Girls are expected to be more empathetic than boys. And one learning difference that has been pegged as innate for, well, forever, is the idea that boys are hardwired to be better at math. For years, study after study said this was so, including a 1980s Johns Hopkins study of almost 10,000 gifted 7th and 8th graders. It found that boys outperformed the girls. And because the children came from the same classrooms, in other words, the same environment, the study concluded the boys had a genetic advantage in math and suggested perhaps girls shouldn't even try, comparing the futility of it to that of a short boy probably never making the basketball team. The influential journal Science published the study. In subsequent updates of this study, the playing field didn't seem quite so level. Parents of boys helped their sons by nurturing their minds with all kinds of extra math toys and books, while this was not the case with parents of gifted girls, who generally found their daughters' math talents surprising and quite accidental. It seems we live in a sea of unconscious gender stereotyping, much the way fish are unconscious of water. In her book, The Female Brain, Lou Anne Brizendine tells us that teenage girls don't do well at math because they're fighting surging hormones. This seems at odds with what's happening in the world of education. For the first time in history, in Canada and the United States, the math gap between males and females has finally closed. In late 2011, a national Canadian report spanning tens of thousands of grade 8 students revealed boys and girls' math skills were even. That's led some academics to suggest that perhaps all along math ability had more to do with gender equality in society than innate difference. In their book, The Truth About Girls and Boys, Rosalind Barnett and Carol Rivers remind us of the Lawrence Summers story. You may remember in 2005, Lawrence Summers, as president of Harvard University, addressed a large academic conference.
Lawrence Summers was addressing an audience of a lot of female scientists and others. He's trying to explain why there were so few women who were in tenure positions at elite universities. And he had a couple of ideas, and one of them was that women just innately didn't have what it took to achieve those levels of success. And in the audience, there were some of the major researchers in this area, and they were very, very upset at him because there was a big body of literature to show how stereotyping and bias and obstructionism was a big part of what was going on and had nothing to do with innate ability. It was a firestorm of reaction, and he had to retract and talk at some point later about the fact that there was no scientific evidence that women are innately less endowed to do mathematics.
Why did he say it then? I mean, this is a very smart man.
There were some people, you know, again, it's speculative, we don't know why, but there are some people on the the Harvard faculty who espouse very much a essentialist perspective that women just are so different. Some of these people seem to have had his ear. And it's also partly, you know, we're part of this culture. And in the culture, there is this belief that math is a male thing, and women who try to achieve in this area are out of their element, and they're not going to be successful.
That must have been humiliating or at least embarrassing for him, was it? I mean, I would imagine.
I think he was. I'll have to hand it to Lawrence Summers. He could have just, you know, gone into a crouch and said, I'm right, to heck with you guys. He did apologize, and he set up a major program at Harvard for women who were interested in math and sciences. So while he certainly put his foot firmly in his mouth, he did go on to make amends and to try to remedy it.
Who do you think's job is more important, your mom's or your dad's?
I know that question.
My dad, he has to build cars for people so he can get money.
Oh, so he builds cars for people?
Yeah.
Oh, and why is that job more important?
It's because that my mom, she just works for stuff, but my dad does more work. He has to build cars for people.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and you're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 159. In the world of the science of sex differences, we've always been told that men and women are innately different in many ways. Medical technology seems to have reinforced this idea. Now the concept that boys and girls have differently structured brains has taken hold of educators, child psychologists, and even parents. And it's fueling a movement to revamp school curriculums and even teach the sexes separately. In the first hour of The Gender Trap, Ideas producer Mary O'Connell looks at where this idea of the two solitudes is coming from.
Over the past decade, high anxiety about the fall of boys has emerged in the culture. Leonard Sachs is one guru on the gendered landscape. A psychologist, he first captured the public's attention in 2005 with his book, Why Gender Matters: What Parents and Teachers Need to Know About the Emerging Science of Sex Differences. One biological truth is that girls' brains mature more quickly than boys. But some educators wonder if boys' brains have always matured later than girls, why now is there what the media call a crisis with boys? In his more recent second book, Boys Adrift, Leonard Sachs answers this question with five reasons, some of which have nothing to do with brain difference. Leonard Sachs points to the reading gap between boys and girls. Many believe testosterone may make some boys a little more fidgety in those early years when reading requires you to sit quietly. Leonard Sachs blames video game usage for shorter attention spans. He also argues that boys have been overdiagnosed with attention deficit disorder and too many prescriptions are being handed out freely. Leonard Sachs also believes there are fewer healthy male role models today. Father Knows Best, he says, has been replaced by Homer Simpson. Because boys and girls are so different, Leonard Sachs has been campaigning for single-sex public schools to foster an achievement culture for boys. Leonard Sachs travels the world selling this message. Here he appears on New Zealand Morning Television.
And he joins me now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
You say that boys are motivated in different ways from girls. So what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, what's really dramatically different between girls and boys, especially amongst the younger children, is what they want to do. The difference is not in what they can do, but in what they want to do. The best way to get boys excited about learning is very different from the best way to get girls excited about learning.
Give me some examples then.
Well, a very simple example is standing versus sitting. We now have lots of evidence that 6-year-old boys, for example, many of them learn better when they're standing. If you ask them to sit still and be quiet, as one teacher said to me, she said, when that boy sits down, his brain shuts off.
Hundreds of single-sex public schools have been cropping up in the United States. In Alabama, for instance, where there is a great concentration, schools once segregated along racial lines are now dividing along gender lines. Some are calling this gender apartheid. In Canada, cities like Hamilton and Montreal have already opened boys-only public schools. Some of the ideas underlying single-sex public schools seem like old-fashioned notions about girls and boys. Ideas like boys need a competitive learning environment, girls succeed in a cooperative one. Girls should not have time limits on tests, while boys should. Testosterone makes boys naturally better at mathematics. Rosalind Barnett and Carol Rivers have followed Leonard Sachs's work.
Well, I certainly think that Leonard Sachs, who is a campaigner for single-sex public schools, says things that are not scientifically true. You know, he says that boys need to be yelled at and girls have to be spoken to softly because of their hearing differences. None of that is true.
Another thing he says is that girls and boys have different brains. Girls have a proclivity to learn language skills and all kinds of verbal skills better than boys. And boys are much more adept at math, and they need to be taught, he calls it gender-specific brain learning. He also goes on to say that boy classrooms should be geared for the boy who needs to be active physically, to running around, standing up, being in motion, whereas girls are more interested in relationships and need to be in learning circles where they can see each other and converse quietly.
My understanding, though, is that more physical activity integrated into the school curriculum is good for boys and girls. I thought, did you talk to anyone about this?
It was a university professor, University of Indiana, Illinois rather, Urbain Champagne. He's done a lot of work in kinesiology and cognitive abilities, and he's found that there's a terrific boost that kids get in terms of learning when the learning is preceded by aerobic physical activity. He said he's looked for gender differences in every study that he's done, and he's never found any evidence that girls and boys differ, that what's good for kids is gross motor activity in a learning environment, and that's true for girls as well as boys.
I think there's a lot going on, though, beneath the surface. So can you talk about what's driving this trend?
I think several things. One is real fear about kids because we're in a bad economic times. Parents are very worried. I think that there's a book out called The End of Men. We have this idea that boys are failing. So I think people are groping around for any solution. There's a backlash out there against the women's movement. Too much has been done for girls, and now we've got to worry about boys. That's sort of the feeling out there.
The big difference in graduation rates is due to the racial differences and to the socioeconomic differences.
So in other words, you're saying that race and class are far larger markers of poor academic achievement than gender, in a sense.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. When Newsweek did a cover piece called The Boy Crisis, it put white suburban-looking boys on the cover, which I think really skews the idea, because the people who are in real trouble are, you know, minority kids and poor rural white kids.
Right, right. Now, when boys were ahead quite a bit, when they were ahead of girls in math and science, were there loud calls for sex segregation in public schools then?
No, nobody cared when girls, you know, for the most part, traditionally, if girls weren't doing well in math and science, it was only really until the last decade that people started looking at this and making it an issue. But traditionally, no, there was no call for segregating schools because girls weren't doing
well. Why weren't there?
Well, I think that when girls aren't doing well, they say, well, girls' brains aren't set up for it. Girls aren't innately suited for math and science. It's not a girl thing. So if they don't do well, who should be surprised about that?
Oh, so it was a fait accompli then.
Yeah, exactly.
As the number of single-sex public schools grows, resistance to gender-segregated education is also growing. The Ontario Association for Public Education is petitioning the provincial government, saying this kind of schooling only promotes gender inequality because we know that the more similar boys' and girls' activities are, the more similar their brains will become. The American Civil Liberties Union concludes that, in addition to being unlawful, the rationale behind sex segregation is questionable science that promotes disturbing gender stereotypes.
What are other favorite toys or other favorite things of yours?
It's my turn. No. Yeah. Survival stuff.
Survival stuff? What's that?
It's stuff to, like, stay alive with in the forest without a house. I just really like doing survival because always in the backyard I build shelters.
Oh, so you learn how to build shelters?
Exciting.
And what about, I just asked your friend, your classmate Dimitri, do you play with dolls?
No.
Why not?
I don't know why, but I have a little stuffy penguin.
Like, would you want to play with dolls?
Maybe one day.
Have you ever wanted to play with a doll, or did you when you were younger or a baby?
When I was younger, I wanted to play with dolls.
Did you have any?
No.
Did you ask for any?
Yes.
What did your parents say?
Maybe one day.
Are you sure you want to play with?
Just how boys and girls position themselves in this world doesn't begin and end at school, of course. The family home is the first nest of gender cues and clues. A complex mix of factors will influence the young mind. Everything from the dynamic of the parents' relationship to the number of siblings and what sex they are, to where a family falls on the liberal to authoritarian spectrum. How parents treat their boy or girl often depends on, well, whether they're a boy or girl. A fascinating study around risk-taking asked mothers of 11-month-olds to estimate how steep a slope their child could crawl up. The moms pushed a button to create the estimated angle. Then the toddlers were allowed to see if they could navigate the angle mom had chosen. It turns out girls and boys proved equally adept on the slope. However, the mothers of girls underestimated their daughters' abilities by a significant margin and overestimated their sons' actions. Cordelia Fine says gender stereotypes are the invisible hand that guides us in terms of what we already expect to see. And often what we expect to see, we then believe is fixed and never changing. Cordelia Fine is an associate professor at the Center for Ethical Leadership at the University of Melbourne, Australia. She thinks we should pay attention to what social psychologists have to say about gender, something she writes about in her book, Delusions of Gender.
So what social psychologists, they take a very different perspective on gender. And I mean, as they see it, gender is sort of in our minds. So we have this tangled mass of associations, implicit beliefs and so on about gender that we've accrued over our lifetime. And what they've shown in just a series of studies is that the social environment, when it makes gender salient, even in a very subtle way, it has this kind of ripple effect on the mind. So our thinking and the way we behave and the way we perceive others and even the way we perceive our own selves becomes more consistent with gender stereotypes. And this particular French study was just one example of this phenomenon. So what they did was they took a bunch of French students, and some of them they were asked to rate the truth of gender stereotypes about boys and girls and arts and maths abilities. And then there was, of course, a control condition where gender stereotypes weren't primed. And then the children were asked to try and remember their scores on a national standardized test, that a very important test that they'd taken about 2 years earlier. And what they found was that in the gender primed group, but not the control group, the girls sort of slightly enhanced the score that they thought they'd got in the arts subjects. And the boys enhanced the score that they thought that they had got in maths, while girls actually lowered their score by about the same amount. So it was actually a boy and a girl who had actually got exactly the same score in that maths test. There would actually be a significant gap between how, you know, he's remembering he did quite a bit better and she's remembering that she did worse. And, you know, how does that impact their future decisions and so on? So it was a very interesting study, and just one of many that shows a similar kind of phenomenon.
It's not hard to find example after example that shows how our assumptions imprint upon our children. Neuroscientist Lise Elliott says that innately, girls have slightly less interest in puzzles and building toys. When this lack of interest is reinforced instead of challenged, it eventually turns into a gap between girls and boys in spatial skills and map reading. But neuroplasticity can change all that. Parents and teachers see often a boy lagging in reading and verbal skills and shrug it off with, "But of course, he's a boy." There's a feedback loop at work. Rosalind Barnett and Carol Rivers believe the root of the reading gap may start quite early with boys. As studies have noted, mothers themselves unconsciously speak differently to a son than to a daughter.
This is fairly new research in which researchers looked at the way mothers talk to their daughters and their sons, and there was much more emotional content in the way they would talk to the girls. They would say things like, "Oh, do you like that doll? Why do you like it?" A more sort of emotional and more detailed conversation with girls, whereas more often with the boys, it was like commands, "Pick that up, don't do this, do this." So they speculate that possibly one reason that girls may get in sort of an early heads up with verbal abilities is because of the kind of language. It's less rich than for the boys and for the girls.
Well, mothers listening, though, might feel, well, how can that be true? I mean, I love my son. I wouldn't speak to him differently than my daughter.
Well, I think the point is that we all want to do the best for our children. There's no doubt about that. But some of these behaviors are so ingrained. They're not in unconscious awareness. And one of the main points of reasons we wrote this book was to make some of these behaviors and thoughts consciously available to parents so they could correct them.
Many educators, psychologists, and parents do wonder, if boys were allowed to engage in richer emotional exchanges, what might that mean for them? In his book, Real Boys, Harvard psychologist Bill Pollack writes about the inner lives of boys and how many talk to him about how masculinity is set up as an impossible test. He says that baby boys are just as expressive as baby girls, but over time, they learn to suppress their emotions. This robs them of a deeper emotional life, and masculinity becomes a contest. Educators wonder, would we hear as many horror stories around bullying, for instance, where the pressure to uphold masculinity is extraordinary? The science of sex differences has always been fertile ground for study and the planting of ideas. In her book, The Female Brain, Lou Anne Brizendine states, women's intuition is hardwired to the point where men think women can read their minds. Rosalind Barnett believes the late psychoanalyst Jean Baker Miller was closer to the mark when she said, "It's not about the brain." Over centuries, women have had less power, and it's taught them to be very mindful. It's not women's intuition, she said, but subordinates' intuition. Jean Baker Miller used the example of blacks and whites, saying, For the longest time, whites didn't have to worry about what blacks thought of them. But blacks sure had to worry. A common touchstone in the science of sex differences remains the various explanations for why women have failed to achieve political office in greater numbers. Looking at North America and Europe, for instance, men still occupy up to 85% of political seats. A long line of psychologists and scientists have noted over the years that women may not have the biological oomph for political life. Another line of reasoning goes, women could run the world, they're just not interested. And then there are academics like Luann Brizendine who say women's biology dictates that babies are more important than a demanding career, and this explains why there aren't more women in political life.
I think that women, at least our endogenous most primitive wiring in female brains for 100,000 years have been that we are the people who have to keep the family together. We are the people who keep the infants alive. We have to keep the children moving forward. We have to keep them safe. And that is the matrix of how females are wired, so that the desire of females to have power is always in conflict a bit, or can be in conflict with that other drive that they have. So I think men do not have that conflict in themselves at all times, which most mothers do have. So if there's a piece that women drop, they drop the work piece, I think that that has a lot to do with a lot of what you see in terms of gender differences in professions and in different types of jobs and political careers.
But this biological argument then doesn't hold. I mean, take Sweden, for instance. Women there occupy almost half, 45% of political seats.
Yeah.
They don't have male brains, I'm assuming.
No.
And Swedish women must have children, too. But
right.
They run in great numbers for political office. So what other explanations can there be?
If you look at what Sweden does in terms of support for moms with kids, there's a huge amount more there than there is in North America. Certainly in the United States, there's very little for maternity leave, for helping care for the kids. So if the culture is very supportive of women going into politics and very supportive of having a lot of government-sponsored childcare or corporation-sponsored childcare, you may have a whole different formula within 20 years that could really that could move the ball forward in terms of more representation for women.
So it seems then it's culture, not biology, that determines how many women get into political office, and that's why you just have a few women politicians in general here and there.
Right. So I think that women who, at least I'm thinking about Nancy Pelosi in our country, you know, and that have huge amounts of support from their husbands. I'm thinking of Margaret Thatcher, you know, who had a huge amount of support, you know, certainly from her husband. If a man were the type of guy who can just be the man behind the throne, so to speak, the man behind the woman, that certainly that it has to start at home.
So, in other words, biology can't explain why women don't have political and economic power. It's because they don't get support.
Right.
The idea of a female brain has become to many an unconscious assumption, a theory that tells us, on average, many women would prefer to give up their professional work life in order to raise children. The New York Times Magazine captured this sentiment in an article titled "The Opt-Out Revolution," quoting one big career stay-at-home mom who concluded, "It's all in the MRI." And that would seem to make the hardwired theory the end of the story. However, the little we know so far about neuroplasticity tells us we're really only at the beginning. When societal systems are put in place to support women, questions of innate abilities appear to disappear. How else to explain how quickly women have climbed the corporate ladder in some European countries after being told they don't have a head for finance? In Norway, for instance, in 2003, only 6% of women were members of corporate boardrooms. Then a quota system was set up to create gender balance. Encouraged by harsh penalties, Norwegian companies suddenly started hiring, and women members of boardrooms jumped from 6 to 40%. The same thing happened in France and in Spain. The sky did not fall. But there has been pushback, too. Joseph Ackermann, the chief executive of Deutsche Bank, caused a firestorm when he commented a few years ago that more women on the bank's executive board would make it prettier and more colorful. Cordelia Fine is the author of Delusions of Gender.
The economist Laurie Beeman did a very interesting investigation of the psychological trickle-down effects of this kind of high-level intervention. So she and her colleagues exploited a kind of natural experiment in India, where in 1993 there was a political gender quota system implemented. So what this particular quota system meant was that within local councils, a leadership position was reserved for women in randomly selected regions. What they found was that 10 years on, women were more likely to stand for and to win elected positions in councils that had reserved positions for women in the previous 2 years. And they also found that the men under those particular councils that had had women leaderships, their previously biased perception of women's leadership abilities had reduced. But what was also really fascinating about the effects of this quota system was the effect that it had on boys and girl adolescents' aspirations. What happened was that the girls' aspirations were enhanced by being under female leaders. So the educational gap between the boys and girls disappeared, and the female aspirations and also the parents' aspirations for their daughters also changed. So this is showing how this just 2 years under female leadership is actually influencing our scientific understanding of ourselves and of men and women and the difference between us has tangible psychological effects. It actually influences the way we think of other people, the way we think of ourselves, the sorts of policies that we think should be introduced. They're not socially neutral.
And working environments, as we know, aren't socially neutral either. There was an interesting example in the late 1990s when Mike Cook, the president of one of the largest accounting companies in the world, Deloitte & Touche, made it policy to hire equal numbers of men and women after earning their degrees. But 10 years later, he noticed most of the promising women were gone. And he asked his managers to find out why, and they said, well, they're taking care of the kids they've had. But Mike Cook said, we'll find out. Don't assume that. And the managers tracked down all these women, and it was complicated. Some did leave for family reasons, but many also talked about how the workplace environment was stacked against them.
Well, I think that's really interesting, and the importance of not just chalking up women's dropping out to this sort of innate nurturing desire. And what's fascinating to me is this assumption that there is an equal playing field for men and women. You know, people had this even 100 years ago. And in retrospect, we can look back with hindsight, we can say, well, how extraordinary that they could think that women had an equal chance of success and to show and develop ambition. And I think in 50 or 100 years' time, we could look back at this era and look at all these phenomena and say, how extraordinary to think that people thought that women had an equal playing field.
The Gender Trap was written and presented by Mary O'Connell. Thanks to Ken Pewley in Radio Archives, and special thanks to Nuala, Robin, Dimitri, Colin, Ruby, and Alina in their role as playing children.